One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Extreme cold weather advisory in effect this morning.
You're a contractor. You have a contract.
All right, guys, come on. Let's do this.
A little snow and ice isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1-pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
I am George Knapp, listening to That UFO Podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today by a sociocultural anthropologist with a PhD from University of California, Berkeley. He is an author and co-founder of the Sol Foundation alongside Dr. Gary Nolan. Finally, I'd love to welcome to the podcast Dr. Peter Skefish. Peter, welcome.
Andy, it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me on. I'm a fan of the podcast.
Thank you. Really appreciate you saying that. And I just mentioned to you, very popular name when I brought you up. You've not done too many interviews outside of a handful that I've seen online that aren't the Sol Foundation's own talks that are put up and obviously really well done. So it's really good to have you on. Really interested to hear your thoughts, opinions on this conversation. But before we get into some of the questions, Peter, let's give the listeners and viewers, in your own words, a little bit about your background and kind of what's brought you to the UFO UAP conversation.
Okay, yeah. How I got here is a long, long story. So let me tell you first a bit about who I am, both as an academic and intellectual, but also professionally. And listeners, give me a moment for my voice to warm up. It's still morning on a Saturday in California, so as we're recording. I am, as Andy said, a sociocultural anthropologist. I'm also effectively a philosopher, although my PhD is in cultural anthropology, and I did that at Berkeley, as Andy said. And what I worked on before turning to UAP broadly in anthropology are a set of problems or topics which I could list as follows: religion. I think everyone knows what that is. Modernity, which is often the name we use for the historical era that begins in the 17th century, and that in which we see institutions like science as we know it today, democratic and liberal forms of governance, secularization or separation of church and state. That's not an institution, but a secularization process. Defining traits of our times come to the fore in the 17th century. And I study modernity as a way of thinking or an ontology, by which we could mean broadly a theory of reality. That's not quite what that means in philosophy, but I think that's very good for our purposes. So religion, ontology, modernity, and within religion, I looked very closely in my book, Rough Metaphysics, at things we could call noetic or psi phenomena. This was a book about among other things, a specific medium and mediumship. And I was not trying to say that what was taking place in for that person was real or unreal. I was trying to think about the how the question of whether it's real might be badly posed if we don't understand the ontology of such things. So that's broadly who I am as a scholar. I work full time in my work right now on UAP and so-called, I don't like the term non-human intelligence. I do research with experiencers and other people who have had encounters with UAP and the apparent or alleged occupants. And I've had a pretty, for an academic, I've had a kind of enviable career because I've been at a lot of great institutions throughout the world. But it's been without a lot of stability. It's me moving from institution to institution, founding projects and so on. So because this is important to understand the international or let's say the international approach and not just the American approach I bring to the topic. I was for a number of years in Paris at university at the top of the academic system there called the Collège de France or the College of France. It's people usually think the peak is the Sorbonne, but this is a place across the street, literally across the street, that is synonymous with the best in French science and philosophy. I was in Canada, in Quebec, in Montreal, at McGill University, which is a very elite university in Canada. I was in Germany as well at the University of Weimar. We did a collaboration with Gary's lab through Seoul, so there was a kind of Stanford affiliation there that we haven't really publicized. And additionally, I also went back to Berkeley. I will affiliate next year and be a visiting scholar for a period at Harvard's Center for World Religion. And I'm also a fellow at a very interesting interdisciplinary and interprofessional institute that in San Francisco that's just called The Institute. So I'm mentioning all that, though, not just to, it's not about my CV, but to give people a sense really of who I am professionally and where I'm coming from in academia.
It's a really interesting background, and I'm glad you did, because I don't think I could have put that across as well in an introduction. And that leads me on then to setting the scene a little bit here. And where would you say things currently stand in the United States when it comes to UAP? So thinking across the board here, Peter, government disclosure efforts, scientific and academic interests, private sector involvement, how civil society is engaging with the topic, what's the historical context that's brought us to this moment, and how does it all fit together?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think that so much has been happening in the United States that even people here are having difficulty tracking it all and keeping up with it. I would say that from what I can see, the last 6-7 months we've crossed another threshold in terms of public acceptance in the United States of the topic. I'm going to first point to what's taking place in San Francisco, where, Seoul is, kind of de facto based in the Bay Area, although we straddle the United States and Europe in terms of who the key people are. But Gary, Nolan, and I are both here in the Bay Area, and I'm living in San Francisco again after some time away. I do a lot of networking and fundraising on behalf of Seoul, and really it's also education on the issue. in San Francisco and the area. And among technologists, venture capitalists, and investors, I would say 35 and under, this is completely acceptable now. And for many of them, it's exciting. And so we saw recently here an event that Sol participated in and supported, which was a UAP hackathon that took place on a decommissioned battleship that's very well known around here called the USS Hornet. And I was really, wanted to be supportive anyway before the event took place, because I thought I knew the people organizing and they're smart and they're, they clearly can be emerging figures from the next generation on this. But it was a really impressive event because they brought together some really brilliant technologists and a lot of really smart technologists as well, and had them working on data problems for a weekend. And that's symbolic of what's taking place in the Bay Area. The people in AI, robotics, neurotech, synthetic biology, all sorts of fields like this, that, you know, where a lot in the space industry, where a lot of capital flows, they're really into this and they accept it. And they are even into the weird noetic dimensions of it. So seeing that over the last 6 months, 7 months has convinced me that we're at a new point with I think what's been an event that started in maybe 2015, 2016. I think the event starts for me, that may be strange for people to hear this, but it starts for me with Tom DeLonge starting to do something that sounded like, the beginnings of disclosure, something, you know, that was, you know, probably initiated ad hoc by some people in the Air Force and some defense contractors, maybe the CIA, but he, you know, even though I think he instigated that, I do think people saw the opportunity. So from 2015 until now, about 10 years, we're in a historical event. We don't know where we are in the event, okay? The nature of a historical event is if you're in the middle of World War II, you don't know you're in the middle of it. You don't know if it's going to drag on. And so we've been in this event for 10 years, and we're at a kind of threshold moment in it, though, because what I see taking place here is that the amount of acceptability and enthusiasm about the issue here is an indication of what will happen in the rest of the United States. San Francisco tends to set the agenda on a lot of topics in terms of their social and cultural acceptability, but also what private capital does with them. So that's very significant to understand, because I think that people should be confident that, I don't know about government disclosure, but that we reach public consensus in the U.S. at some point, and then we know the world will start to follow. It's not because the U.S. is inherently, somehow, more important or something. And I have lived in Europe a lot, so I don't like the American parochialism around this conversation, but, the center of gravity is here. So that's very significant to know. Now, briefly, to answer the rest of the question, I think that, look, we've seen remarkable things take place in Congress, as well as in terms of even in the executive branch. The executive branch of the U.S. government, the U.S. Congress, where UAP are concerned. And we should be very excited that things continue to happen in Congress. However, I think we're going to be in a moment in terms of actual tangible outcomes in DC over the next couple of years. Love him or hate him, whatever assessment you want to make of him politically, I don't think Donald Trump and his administration are going to create a context in which it would be easy for anyone in that administration to take the initial steps that would need to be taken to make something like disclosure happen. It's a very chaotic environment in DC. And I think some of the chaos that has been caused by effectively a downsizing attempt across federal agencies and departments, and one that hasn't been executed, I think, in a productive way, is that I think you're going to see a lot of people in the DOD, other component, the intelligence community, a little nervous about participating in any kind of congressionally directed disclosure act if they feel that their risk to what they view as national security anyway, right? You're creating a leaky environment if you have a lot of disgruntled employees and if you have a lot of uncertainty in parts of the U.S. government that are engaged in sensitive activities, where they want to feel that there's stability if they're going to reform secrecy on an issue. That said, I think an exciting thing is that there's a good chance, we don't know for sure, but there's a good chance that Michael Rounds reintroduces the UAP Disclosure Act this summer. And a lot of the organizations, including the Seoul Foundation, are standing ready to support that. We absolutely think it should be passed. That's the best shot we've got at this right now. There's no other legislative plan for this. And the long and short of it is that if you think you're going to get disclosure from a presidential administration, you would be wrong unless you know there's someone whose job it is to handle that. So you know, a simple thing that's forgotten about the Disclosure Act is it doesn't just appoint one person; it would appoint nine people to handle that, exactly what you need. So you know, what I would say is the state of play in D.C. is, I think we should expect things to go much more slowly than people might want, but at the same time, we do have that on the horizon. And that could set up a process that I think would probably outlast the Trump administration, but it could get set up. So, yeah, I didn't answer your question in full, but I think that's a good place to kind of clip it off.
Can you just expand on the hackathon? I'm glad you brought that up. I was speaking to Deep Prasad about it at the time when it was mentioned, and you talk about the Bay Area of San Francisco and a lot of the innovation that comes from there, a lot of the thinking then bleeds through into wider society. What would the kind of the first blooms of that be that laymen and folks like myself would start to see the impacts of that coming from a UAP point of view? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I mean, the event itself is something like that because, you know, the way that technologists have always operated, I think, since the 70s in the Bay Area. So, you know, the Bay Area is, you know, this is like when people talk about the New York metropolitan area and you have no idea what they're talking about, is San Francisco. It's across the San Francisco Bay is Berkeley, which is where the University of California, Berkeley is. It's Oakland, historically, the great African-American city of Northern California. As you go south from San Francisco, you get Palo Alto, where Silicon Valley is, and where Silicon Valley is adjacent. And, you know, it's as you go down to the valley, that's where a lot of the venture capital firms are, and that's where a lot of the, as everyone knows, a lot of the startups happened that became the Facebooks and the Googles of the world. And that stretches all the way down to city in what we call the South Bay, which is the city of San Jose, and you have you know, that's part of the Bay Area as well. So now that we know what we're talking about, the way that you know, starting with information scientists, but then going out into other fields like biotech, the way that technologists here have tended to work is, I think it's been play first and work second, where they're looking at problems they want to solve from an engineering or scientific perspective, and they start working on them whether or not they have capital or a company to support that. So when you see people getting together and doing things like hackathons, that's first a sign that they're playing, but second, it means that somebody is looking at the field and going, I better do a hackathon because I need to position myself in a place to get the talent coming to me. The nice thing about that in the Bay Area is that, and I'm, you know, I'm not part of the VC world except through my work in Seoul. I'm something, you know, I'm adjacent to it. But the nice thing about that here is that there is a real sense of security among these people because they're not, you know, they know a really good idea is something that can circulate around, and that it's going to take a lot of intelligence and talent to realize it. So they tend not to grip their ideas. They tend not to hold too tight to their projects or their capital. They know everybody kind of benefits from an atmosphere like that. So that sign is something that that hackathon itself is important. But you also want to look at signs of interest. And I'm not talking about Peter Thiel, because everyone thinks that, you know, there's a kind of secret interest in this or a long game with Peter Thiel on UAP. I actually don't think that's the case. But you want to look at what different venture capitalists may have to say about this, who are kind of hyper successful. And you want to look at occasional remarks made by people in artificial intelligence as well. You know, these are, you know, in both the VCs and some of the AI people, there's very strong interest in this. I'm not saying that's in huge numbers, but there are some people who are very, very interested, and you're eventually going to see them make public remarks about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Moving on then, you've said on many occasions that UFOs, UAP, have been fictionalized for decades, and that's true, and that's made it harder for many to find, you know, the true facts. And I wonder then, Peter, what for you are the facts of the UAP reality that can often get lost but are important to adhere to when it comes to treating the topic seriously as a science?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Something I'll say to preface this, and I'll try to speed up my answers here, because I know I'm being a bit of an academic right now by giving long answers. But something I'll give as background is that people in fields like mine, social and cultural anthropology, and this applies to the history and philosophy of science, sociology of science, some of the more experimental and philosophical fields in the humanities and humanistic social sciences, people in these fields like myself, we know that a fact is both, it's a paradoxical and to some extent contradictory entity. It's something that we attribute to reality or nature, and we say it's objectively there. And yet a lot of social and subjective work goes into establishing a fact, even to constructing a fact. So with UAP, this is a really tricky thing for someone like myself, because on the one hand, I'm going to resist saying there are facts per se, but I also know we have to establish them, and that's a process that isn't entirely objective. The advantage of that is that we know that there's something about UAP that doesn't fit into reality very well. And so something that's elusive about UAP is that, you know, they don't seem to, you know, when we talk about them, when we study them, they don't seem to distribute well into sets of facts, if that makes sense. Now, that said, I do think there are some things that are true and that we should really seek to establish publicly as facts. One of them, and this is pretty fundamental to me, is that these are physical, and these are tangible and thus physical objects. I could say they're tangible as well as perceptible with the other senses. And we know they're physical for that reason. We can also detect them with sensors of different kinds and instruments of different kinds. Now, this is important because unless we're willing to say that UAP are a completely special class of things or objects, they probably are continuous in space and time, at least when they're not doing some kind of extraordinary thing that would be related to travel or movement, as we might define those things conventionally. That's to say that, you know, we see them doing a lot of strange things, or witnesses see them doing a lot of strange things. But they are not morphing generally into dragons or giants, or you see, or into things so anomalous that we can't make sense of them, that our senses can't pick them up. I know we have cases like that, but I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind, because otherwise we start to lose ground truth about this, which is that we are dealing again with something that is physical. Now, that doesn't exclude other dimensions to it, okay, including dimensions that are not that don't require us to reform science. Like they have a social or they have a political dimension, okay. But they are physical objects, and in as much as they're physical objects, we have to contend with them that way. We can't simply assume that the way we study them would. We can't assume that they're so strange that they go beyond the ability of science to study them, the ability of journalists to investigate them, even the ability of witnesses to make sense of them. Once we do that, we can actually start to talk about and think about what they are and ask good questions about them. I think we want to avoid theories that, let's say, don't involve parsimonious explanation. You don't want the theory about the UAP to be too complicated, and you also want it to be something that reflects data and things that we would argue are facts. We don't want to go too far beyond that. So I'm very hesitant to accept that, for example, all UAP, especially those that appear to be vehicles, are somehow the manifestations of some kind of non-physical superintelligence or something from a radically different reality that just happens to show us things that appear to be technological objects. If somebody wants to make that argument, I want to know what the other things are that that supposed intelligence is manifesting. So that's one thing I would say is a fact. Maybe you could follow up. If you want me to continue, but you may have a reply there.
No. I'd be interested to hear what else, because do you feel conflicted as an academic when you're trying to have a rational conversation about something that is often so irrational, though? That baseline of what is a fact and something that is so speculative, where do you, I get your point, where do you begin to draw that baseline of, okay, here is a fact about UAP?
Well, no, I don't feel conflicted as an academic or an intellectual, because in all of my work prior to doing this, I was dealing, first when you're dealing with philosophical questions, which I do, and I deal with them in a way that is much like what a philosopher does, not just an anthropologist, you're working at an incredible level of abstraction. So you have to be very, very cautious in how you appeal to evidence for your arguments, how you articulate an argument, how you select the principles that guide your argument. And in a way, it's much more difficult than scientific work, because you don't have anything tangible to go on. Okay, so it's very disorienting for scientists when they see people going about the business of philosophy, because they think, well, like, I don't even know what you're talking about in the first place. I need something in my hand, or I need data from an instrument, and I need to know what's objectively true here. Well, there's nothing like objective truth if you're talking about something like philosophical problems like freedom, what the state is. And that's not even to begin to broach issues that are epistemological or ontological. I mean, ontology, you're dealing with something like the nature of reality. So I'm very comfortable with the speculative, but speculation has to be done rigorously. It has to be done methodically. And I would distinguish speculation from conjecture. That's what we get a lot with UAP. But you're asking about something deeper here, which is that we do know that there's a dimension to UAP, which, let's say, it appears to defy reason. I want to be very careful about that, because sometimes things that appear to defy reason, they simply defy our ability to use our reasoning powers well, or we haven't figured out how to reason about them. So I'm comfortable there too. I'll tell you what I'm not comfortable with is an easy conflation of religious experience, and which is a That's a term of art. That means the experience people have when they're practicing things that a scholar would say is religion, okay, whether or not it understands itself to be religion. The conflation of religious experience with the experience of UAP. That's a core, the idea that there's a continuity between the two things is a core tenet of and a core idea in Jacques Vallée's work. Diana Pasulka, I think also to some extent, thinks that. And it's a really interesting claim, okay? And it's a claim I'm very interested in myself. But I think what people take away from their work is the idea that there's something called the phenomenon. And we all know what the phenomenon is. I'm not sure what most people mean by that. And that it's been influencing human beings for before they have historical memory for millennia and millennia, and that most religious experience is a product of the phenomenon, and somehow the phenomenon is producing UAP. I'm not comfortable with that as a claim, and I'm not comfortable with it because it's such a broad claim that you couldn't really investigate it intellectually, academically, certainly not scientifically in the sense of the hard sciences. But in a way, that's a claim that belongs much more in religion than it does intellectual inquiry. It could be a theological claim. And no surprise that a lot of people observing what's taking place in the UAP milieu who are academics see the UAP seen as being a new religious movement, okay? And we have a lot of religious ideas attached to UAP and the idea that they're, that they're the sources of a new kind of revelation. People have been having what we call downloads. That's not something that started happening just this century. This is inspiration or a feeling of the gods or God speaking to you. That's very core to human experience, as far as I know, as an anthropologist. And so we want to be very careful in thinking all this is unique and that all of it has something to do with UAP. And by UAP, again, I mean things that are physical objects, they're technological, and they sure look like vehicles.
Okay. On that then, that's a good place to bring in this question. And I've heard you talking about how we study these objects, and even I hesitate sometimes to say vehicle or craft, or because we're not entirely sure. So there's an assumption there. But whether we're studying these through technological means or more noetic approaches, like you've mentioned, and that there's a limit placed on our understanding because we're using our sensors, our equipment, and even consciousness in the way they're currently configured. Could it be we're missing something fundamental simply because we're not tuned into the right mode of perception or interaction? And if so, what might a different mode of engagement look like?
I agree with you about this, but let's unpack a lot of the different concerns you have with limiting this to the physical and to the idea that these are vehicles before we try to answer the question. I might ask you, simply because it'll help us discuss this, like, what do you think the data points are that suggest that these aren't vehicles or that these aren't technological?
I suppose putting me on the spot, Peter, asking me a question on my own show.
I know. Yeah,
It's very fair. I suppose more recently, as an example, the Jake Barber and Skywatcher and what they are claiming to summon. There's a lot of assumption these are craft, but all we're seeing is a light in the sky. We don't know that when these things come closer, they're physical, non-physical objects made purely of light, plasma, something else. We literally don't know. So we have to assume that, this thing is, and you mentioned earlier, this thing is quote unquote flying in the sky or traveling. We don't know that it's even doing that. It could be closer to swimming than flying, but again, we don't know because we don't have access to that sort of data. So I'm hesitant unless I see something as physically, you know, looks like if I walk up to it and knock on it, it's going to go ding, ding, ding.
Okay. This is good. I appreciate this. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but we can start to discuss this in a way that is concrete. So we have a lot of witnesses who have seen something. They're absolutely convinced that if they walked up to it, they could knock on it. It would resound like metal. Okay. And certainly we have the few cases where people did walk up to these things and touch them or gather, and I think we have the chain of custody to say this actually happened, or gather materials that they ejected or somehow left behind. And then we have, and I'll come to it in a second, we have the testimony that the U.S. government, in fact, possesses a number of retrieved vehicles and certainly some materials. So that's a point of entry into a big data pool in which what people are seeing are definitely things that look like vehicles. And let's go through some of the traits that were that witnesses ascribed to them in their testimony and that investigators were confident were there. Okay, we have things like landing gear, tripod legs that the craft rest on. People describe doors commonly. They describe things that, you know, at least function as windows. I'm doubting they're made of glass, but it's very common that people say, look, this thing had apertures that were sending light out, and I could see into the inside of the vehicle. They also at times have, they're domed on top in a lot of the classical descriptions. And the inference there that people are making, or sometimes they're seeing occupants in the dome, is that dome is there so that there's more space for whatever or whomever is inside the thing. And then there are landing traces, very clear descriptions from aviators of these things interacting with them, just as you would expect if they were vehicles. Now, they're not flying or moving, probably, right? They're moving space rather than moving through space. I think we have to accept that if we accept the claims about the performance characteristics, including the unimaginable velocity these things are going at. So that's why I'm confident that a big pool of the UAP data does suggest these things are vehicles. And I would add that I think that if all UAP were something like balls of plasma or something we can't quite understand because let's just say we can't understand it scientifically. We're not familiar with it as the kind of phenomenon it is. I don't think you would have much of a drama in the U.S. government about this. You would be able to release the data without a lot of trouble if it didn't appear to be what a lot of people think it is, which is a machine or a technology that does seem to be doing things like reconnaissance or observation, maybe scientific study, and that's certainly interacting with civilian and military aircraft in a way that is potentially dangerous to them. And I would add one last thing there, which is that I would say I know for a fact, and I'm skeptical of facts, I know for a fact that there's UAP government, UAP secrecy in the U.S. government. I have no doubt about that, and I have no doubt about that because of my own inquiry into this, well prior to the Seoul Foundation, my own experiences of butting up against it, knowing, for instance, someone who knew someone that was just one degree of separation away from me, who was in the Legacy program. But also in my work in Seoul, I've had to do work where it has been made clear to me in no uncertain terms by people who would be exactly in the position to know that there really is a U.S. government program that deals with UAP and deals with recovered technology and the reverse engineering of that technology. So what I can't imagine is that there would be that anyone would be confident about that, and that there would be a program devoted to it if you were dealing with something that was intangible. Now, it doesn't mean that it can go from that it can't transition from tangibility to intangibility and maybe come back. That's a matter of perception for us. It could be that it enters some kind of state physically that we don't understand, that could be beyond the senses. But those things also seem to function pretty well in reality as we're able to sense it. So that's why I would say there, we really want to be, you know, clear that it sure looks like there are objects that are vehicular in nature. Now, that said, you brought up claims, I'll just, you know, put it that way, that it's possible somehow to that human thinking and human intention somehow can attract UAP. Now, I want to be very, very careful about that, because I think that we know that people doing C5 work have that experience a lot. I've seen it happen in attending CE5s myself. I also know that, we have to take seriously even very exotic claims coming from the intelligence community about this. But we don't know what's going on there. Once you accept that UAP are real, so long as you accept that they're something that is commensurate with our understanding of reality as we know it, all sorts of other things are going to become true, or they attain a much greater probability of being true than we ever ascribed them before. And I think that, you want to be able to imagine, if you think UAP are real, that some kind of, we have extremely sophisticated surveillance technology, it goes beyond the fact that, we can get off this conversation and you could be someone could listen to everything you say for hours after this through your phone. I think we have much more sophisticated ways of monitoring communication than that even. So what would the makers of UAP have? They very well could monitor thinking in a way that we couldn't imagine. And I'm not trying to appeal to anything supernatural. I'm just saying that, you might be able to recognize in a very sophisticated way brain activity and know what the thought concerns or what a conversation's about. And that could be something that, would attract curiosity from vehicles. That's incredibly conjectural on my part, but I'm just saying, we don't want to jump immediately to knowing that we're dealing with pure consciousness and so on. Last thing I'll say about that is, of course, now that I've said all that, of course, there is a very strong noetic dimension to UAP encounters. But what I would say about that is we don't understand most of that. We really don't understand it. I think what people understand is that it's there. Past that, we've got most of what you can do when you know that UAP events are real, that you know that you've got some data points that are factual, is you can privately reflect on what the implications of those data points might be, if they're fact or if they're true, and talk to others about it. You don't have a body, you don't have science about this. Barely any science about it. You don't have other academic work on this. You have barely any at all. And you do have some study of it in the U.S. intelligence community and probably in the intelligence services of some other countries, but that's not public record information. So most of us are unfortunately stuck, kind of spinning our minds around these things. And, you do that for a number of years, you can form a lot of incorrect inferences about something because, there's nothing to check it against.
Yeah, that is very true. I've always said I try and keep my own opinion fluid, and based on what I see, what I hear from different people, I'll always try and make up my own mind. based on the data presented or opinion or testimony, but I would suggest other people kind of do the same unless you've got that data to look at. I hadn't put much thought into the notion of these craft, again, we'll use are we looking at designers or operators here? And how important do you think it is to drill down into questions like that?
Oh, for me,
and
for
what
me,
the consequences
for
of it
me
being,
currently,
you know?
And I could be wrong about this. I mean, I may regret when I finish the phase of the research I'm doing on this that I think this is the question, but that's the question for me. I mean, look at some of the things that are observed. Okay, and let's take a case everybody thinks happened. Nobody's in doubt about it. Jalen Hynek, Jacques Vallée were not in doubt. People coming out of the intelligence community aren't in doubt about it. State and federal law enforcement weren't in doubt about it. The Socorro landing. And you know, let's look at Lonnie Zamora's testimony. I mean, he's describing something very, very commensurate with not just reality as we experience it, but even with our own human reality. He's describing a vehicle that had a door. He's describing a vehicle that had some way to get up to the door. He's describing bipedal beings outside the vehicle and then going into it. Now, the explanation that may be some kind of display created for our senses and we shouldn't trust it. Okay, you know, that's a hypothesis here. I don't find it a very interesting one because I don't know when I'm supposed to start doubting the testimony of others, when I'm supposed to stop the process of doubt then. And I don't know at what point I'm supposed to stop doubting, being skeptical toward my own experience, my own sense experience then. I mean, if you think that things are being simulated by something that you can't define, how would you limit the power of this thing? I mean, it could be, you know, deceiving you and I right now, we're not actually having this conversation. So that seems a very convoluted way to deal with a case like that, particularly because, you know, Zamora believed he was pursuing or, you know, tracking in his car something that was flying over the landscape and doing it slowly enough that he could do that. But let's go back to some of that, the data that we find in his testimony. What do you need a door for if there are no occupants in the object? Or if it's at least not intended to put something inside it? That something could be us, it could be animals, it could be other things. But and then additionally, you have to have some way of getting whatever you're trying to put inside it into the object or vehicle. So that leads very quickly to the question of whether you're just dealing with designers or operators. All the testimony suggests that there are indeed operators or at least occupants, okay? Whether or not it could all be done by some kind of AI or something, the movement of the vehicle, but all the testimony we have from witnesses goes in the direction to suggest that there are occupants, there are operators, and the question then is, what are they?
Philosophically, then, what do you start to think if we are dealing with operators of these craft or something's operating them? The idea that something else, somewhere else, is designing them and sending them here. How do you start to break down that?
Well. You know, you asked me, you know, maybe in a different sense, how I would deal with that philosophically, and I'll say kind of properly how I think about this philosophically first, and then I think I'll go to, you know, some of the more conjectural questions about this. I gave a talk recently, a plenary talk at the Archives of the Impossible conference at Rice University. The title of that talk, I think it'll get released soon after the video is all reviewed and edited, was The Corporeal Hypothesis. And it was, of course, an allusion to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And I was arguing not against the noetic dimension UAP, but I was trying to make an argument that we need to really study accounts of occupants and what were called humanoids in the 60s and 1970s. And I went through, we can talk about this data at a, in a moment, but I went through a lot of the qualitative data, witness testimony about the occupants, which is bizarre, because it certainly suggests that you're dealing with bipedal human-like beings. And even if we accept, as I do, that a lot of this testimony is accurate, it puts us in front of a possible fact of a scientific nature that defies all science as we know it today. Because there, I think there are very few astrobiologists that predict that you would be encountering things like human beings, this much like a human being. Dorsal asymmetry, faces, nose, noses, mouths, hands, ears, sometimes hair, you know, four or five digits, you know, proportion, much like us, that you would be encountering physical beings like that if they were able to reach us. I mean, there, I think most astrobiologists would predict that you would have very different kinds of, I mean, you would have, you know, something like fish that might develop into social and cultural and technological beings like us, but you wouldn't be encountering them coming out of ships and so on, you know, for example. And then even things that don't correspond to species or kinds of life on Earth as we know it. So this raises for me a philosophical conundrum, which is, how do you make sense of this testimony, and what are its implications if you're seeing something that is like us, very much akin to us? Being an anthropologist who thinks about the radical differences that do exist between different ways of human thinking and different ways of human existing and living, I'm very comfortable with asking a question like that, because often our judgments about what is like and unlike among human beings are very, you know, situated in our place and time. And often we think things are very much like us, which are not like us at all when it comes to human thinking. I'll give you an example. It's a very, you know, it's a very common example, but I think it illustrates the point. You know, when the Jesuits were first working in China and attempting to convert China to Catholicism and translated the Bible into Mandarin, they chose the word Dao to translate God. Now, if you know anything about Taoism, the Dao is nothing like a god of monotheism, whether it's Islamic or Christian or Judaic. You know, it's not just coextensive with nature. In a sense, it is nature. It is everything. And the way a philosopher would describe that is, it doesn't transcend the rest of reality. It's to use a technical term, it's immanent to reality. It's inside reality is a simple way of putting that. So that's a translation that didn't work out very well, and I'm sure it confused a lot of people that the Jesuits were trying to convert. So, you know, but the mistake there is very common to human beings, which is to think that your fundamental categories find equivalents and counterparts in other ways of thinking, and it's just not the case very often. So, you know, let's move over to two ways of thinking and maybe two ways of being that would exist between humans and so-called non-human intelligence. We're going to be continually faced with the problem, if such beings are real, of looking at ourselves in the mirror and saying, this thing is just like me, even though the image it sends back is also going to be radically different. And so I think if I could say that there's a practical way of dealing with this philosophically, the witness data about occupants, and remember that involves a lot of strange things like witness accounts of abductions, is we're looking at beings that are in a way the spitting image of us. They're mirror images of ourselves. And yet they're at the same time very disturbing. They're very uncanny. They're very strange. They're very other. So, you know, I could say both theoretically, as we think about the possibility of extraterrestrial life, interstellar travel, these sorts of things, we will continually be facing conundrums where we don't know what self and other is. And I think when it comes empirically, when we're looking at this kind of data, and if we're ever faced with the moment of public consensus about it, where we have to collectively ask ourselves what it means, we'll be facing that same question. I mean, these things seem to be kin to us in a way, or like us in a way, and yet they're radically other at the same time. That for someone like me, that's something I know how to reflect on. That's a very abstract problem. I can bring some insight to that. But I think you also mean something, very practical to go back to your question, which is, okay, like, can we actually accept the data? Am I correct to follow you on that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is what my work is about right now. I'm writing a book about this, where I'm writing a book about UAP, which is really not just about the UAP. It's about the so-called NHI. It's about the possible operators, the occupants. It's about witness accounts of that. And that's where I think we have to be very flexible, very supple with our interpretations and our hypotheses. Because, you know, there are a lot of people. I mean, Gary Nolan is one of them, and Gary and I talk about this both privately and publicly, who think it's absolutely impossible that what you're looking at is something you should take at face value or assume is self-evident. The likelihood that you're seeing, by this line of argument, something that much like us originating from another planet or some other kind of habitat, to a biologist like Gary or a life scientist like Gary, is extremely low. Now, I think there are other life scientists that would make other arguments and maybe be a little more open to that, but you really have to keep in mind that that you may not want to take this at face value, such accounts, that is. Of course, one thing that you could be seeing are something like biological avatars that have been engineered to interact not just with us, but with interact and function with our environment. I mean, there's a likelihood of that. At the same time, you have to remember 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and it goes up to the present, but especially in those decades, you have a lot of accounts of landings where people see things that seem to be wearing what they describe as diving suits or something like, something like the gear astronauts wear that seem to be like that. Yep. Because precisely because the beings couldn't breathe oxygen, you know, which is one of the arguments, is why could they breathe oxygen? Well, in a lot of the cases that people describe, it doesn't sound like you're dealing with something that can breathe in the atmosphere, so long as we trust the data. So what I'm looking at here is, you know, how do we, you know, the challenge for me is to establish what kind of groupings of data we can trust, not just because it was well gathered and not just because it's consistent from case to case, but because we're able to rule out that what's going on is something so strange that you just don't even want to trust the witness account in the first place. I tend to trust people. My principle here, and there's a principle I'll keep defending and kind of testing, I think, until someone says, look, you know, Scafish, you're just wrong about this, is, you know, I don't think that you want to appeal to the sanity and credibility of witnesses to establish that UAP exists, and then turn around when they talk about occupants and say, well, now we don't trust the witnesses. Okay, we haven't done that with the noetic part of the data. And I think we should likewise not do that with the part of the data that indicates something physical, if not biological.
That is all for part one. Part two will be out in the next couple of days. You can listen to this episode already in full, ad-free and with no sponsors for less than the price of a coffee. If you head on over to Patreon or Apple, you can subscribe to the podcast for less than the price of a coffee or take up the 2 weeks free trial that are available on those platforms. You can head on over to Spotify and search That UFO Podcast Premium and get access to this episode in full, no adverts, no sponsorships, and also with some extra bonus content as well. Thanks for listening, folks.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Build a polished wardrobe that shows you stay you wherever you go with Mack Weldon. Use code MACK25 for 25% off your first order of $125 or more at MackWeldon.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.